Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Margaret Cameron-Ash makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication not so long ago of a book, Line for the Admiralty, which has a foreword from John Howard. Now, I'll introduce our speaker very briefly. Margaret Cameron-Ash is a lawyer, a former visiting fellow at the University of New South Wales and author of Supreme Court and District Courts Practice from the Law Book Company. And after working and lecturing as a lawyer in Sydney and in London, she widened her area of research to include early Australian history with a special interest in cartology. And of course, she's published numerous papers about Captain Cook. And today, topic for tonight's talk is How the Great Navigator Missed Bass Strait, Looking Back at James Cook. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Firstly, I'd like to thank Gerard Henderson for the opportunity to talk to this most distinguished audience tonight on my favourite topic. We're about a quarter of the way through the great sestercentennial commemorating Cook's three-year voyage through the Pacific. I'm delighted to see our president of the Captain Cook Society here tonight, Mal Nicholson. In a couple of days, he's flying to Tahiti to join the international celebrations for the transit of Venus on the 3rd of June, 1769. Bon voyage, Mal. But tonight, we're not looking at Cook's astronomy, or indeed at the scientific program on the Endeavour. Instead, we're turning to Cook's political program, his cloak and dagger activities for Britain's Secret Service. I'm going to look at three of Cook's secrets: the concealment of Bass Strait, the concealment of Sydney Harbour, and the possession ceremony that didn't happen. Before I start, I should explain how such a professional, accurate cartographer got involved with fake maps. The reason was the political climate of the 18th century. The backdrop to Cook's whole life was Britain's Cold War, sometimes shooting war, with France. Anglo-French rivalry loomed over the English Channel for centuries. It started with the Norman conquest and continued into the 19th century. On the eve of his planned invasion of England, which was cancelled, Napoleon rallied the troops by declaiming, "We have six centuries of insults to avenge." Now, Cook started life as a farm boy in Yorkshire, and as a child, he would run up the summit of Rosebery Topping, the 1,000-foot crag near his home. And up here, he spent hours studying the valleys and mountains and gazing north across to the North Sea with the easterly breeze in his face. He first went to sea as in the Merchant Navy, which served him very well because he learnt about the market economy and that Britain's prosperity depended on seaborne trade. He appreciated the importance of deep ports and sea lanes. But after 9 years of transporting freight across the North Sea, the drums of war started rumbling once more, and Cook switched across to the King's Navy. And at the ripe old age of 26, just in time for the French to fight the French in the Seven Years' War, which Britain won. France was humiliated, mainly because she'd lost her almost the whole of her North American empire. Now, this was intolerable, so at the peace negotiations in Paris, the French insisted that they be given two tiny islands off the coast of Newfoundland, so that their fishermen had a beach where they could dry their catch. Now, the British cabinet was the usual mix of hawks and doves, and the hawks were furious at the suggestion. Lord Chatham declared that he would rather lose the use of his right hand than allow France back onto the doorstep of North America. However, the hawks lost, and the doves won, and Britain agreed to give the little islands of Saint-Pierre and Miquelon to France if they promised not to build any fortifications. So that went well, didn't it? So the governor of Newfoundland asked the Admiralty to send James Cook across to survey the coasts of Newfoundland, where the pesky French were making trouble. Cook did this for 5 summers, and in the winters, he returned to London and reported to the Admiralty Secretary, Philip Stevens. Now, as the permanent secretary of a government department, Stevens may have shared some of the foibles of Sir Humphrey Appleby, and yes, Minister. But Stevens had a much larger remit. He ran the Admiralty, and therefore he was one of the most powerful men in England. He was also head of naval intelligence, the spymaster. He was the C of MI6, or the M of the James Bond stories. Excuse me. Now, many of us here tonight can remember life with a backdrop of the Cold War, with its simple binary certainty blowing in and out of our lives. But when I speak to school students who haven't grown up with this, I find that Ian Fleming and John le Carré provide an easy shorthand for conveying the climate in which Captain Cook operated. Stevens was the spymaster, and he personally selected James Cook as his 007. The analogy continues. Both Cook and Bond were patriotic and loyal. Both were naval officers, and for both, their modus operandi was to do whatever it takes. Perhaps the main distinguishing factor was that Captain Cook did not have a girl in every port. Now, Philip Stevens had a special mission for Cook in the new theatre for Anglo-French rivalry. After losing their Northern Empire in the Seven Years' War, the French turned their attention to the Southern Hemisphere. Their first move was to seize the Falkland Islands and plant a French colony there in 1764. This was a frightening wake-up call for the British Admiralty. From now on, Philip Stevens was on high alert. Initially, the main game was the race of the legendary Great South Land, the fabulous Terra Australis. Now, Spain and the Netherlands had searched for this in previous centuries, but those empires were now in decline, and the competition had narrowed down to two. It was just France and Britain. Incidentally, in 18th century terminology, this southern continent was the imagined South Polar continent, a giant Antarctica that stretched far north into the warm, habitable latitudes. It was not, they were not talking about New Holland, as Australia was then known. They already knew that New Holland was not joined to the South Polar continent because Abel Tasman had sailed underneath and cut it off 100 years earlier. When the Royal Society asked for a navy ship to transport astronomers to the Pacific for the transit, Stevens seized the opportunity to do a bit of British exploration on the return journey, and he nominated Cook to lead it. Cook was politically astute. He well understood that the purpose of a voyage of discovery was the advancement of human knowledge. He knew that most of his discoveries would be published by the Admiralty on his return. This would enhance Britain's prestige, boost government popularity, and encourage the taxpayer to support future expeditions. But Cook also knew that he would make strategic discoveries that were too valuable to publicise. These included new sea lanes, shortcuts, offshore islands, and deep harbours. All of these were vital for wartime battle and peacetime trade. Basically, this was Britain's intellectual property, and it had to be protected. Now, the only way to protect a valuable feature like that, short of occupation, was to use the age-old practice of cartographic secrecy. The navigator had to conceal the strategic feature either by omitting it from his map or by falsifying the coastline. In this way, he hoped to deflect foreign interest and buy some time until his government could afford to garrison the place. Cook's so-called errors were in fact subterfuge. The Admiralty's strategy to prevent others, particularly the French, from learning of discoveries which they could turn to their advantage. So the voyage begins in 1768, and I should here make a very quick mention of Cook's paying passenger. This was the rich young man about town, Joseph Banks, because he is my independent witness. Like Cook, Banks wrote a detailed and fascinating journal, but unlike Cook, he wrote it quite openly, free of the self-censorship acquired through age and experience and naval discipline. Where Cook's journal is silent on a matter, it is often Banks's journal that supplies the crucial evidence that points to Cook's deliberate error or falsification. Now, they arrived at Tahiti in good time to observe the transit of Venus, and that done, the Admiralty had ordered Cook to sail directly south to discover the southern continent. Now, Cook knew he wouldn't find a polar continent within the 40-degree limit he'd been given, but he obeyed anyway because that's what he did, unlike most other navigators of the period. As expected, they only found mountainous seas and piercing gales, and poor Banks was horribly seasick. Now, next, Cook was ordered to turn west to New Zealand and sail around it, thereby proving that it wasn't joined to Antarctica. After this, he'd completed his list of instructions, and after a year and a half at sea, everyone was ready to go home. And Cook decided that on the way, he'd survey the east coast of New Holland. And so now we come to the problem of Bass Strait. Many years ago, after a day's sailing, a veteran of the Sydney to Hobart yacht race told me that he couldn't understand how the great Captain Cook had missed Bass Strait when he was in it in 1770. In fact, he said that Cook was probably a bit of a fool and poured us both another drink. Now, the old sailor probably had a point. Either the great navigator was a bit of a fool, or he had fiddled his charts. Both possibilities amounted to heresy, but I battered on. Now, Cook had done his homework before he left England, and I think he'd guessed that from Tasman's records that Van Diemen's Land was, in fact, an island. If so, it was a problem. His experience with the French in Newfoundland had taught him the danger of offshore islands. They could be used by your enemy to make trouble. If there was a strait there, Cook would conceal it by suggesting the island was a peninsula when he drew his chart. He had already done this a month earlier in New Zealand when he concealed Favo's Strait and joined Stewart Island to the mainland. So he headed across the Tasman Sea, and Zachary Hicks sighted land at 6 o'clock in the morning in April 1770. Hicks had seen some unspecified hill up in the hinterland behind the south coast of Victoria. In due course, he would receive his Spotter's Prize, which was a gallon of rum, plus the honour of having some other landmark named after him. Meanwhile, Cook thought he was in a strait, but he had to make sure, so he continued sailing west for another 2 hours. By 8 a.m. he was certain, so he very quickly turned the ship around and headed back to Cape Howe and the East Coast. He didn't want to advertise the strait to the crew for any longer than was absolutely necessary. Sailors were poorly paid in those days and were known to sell information to foreigners. Now, Captain Cook had resolved the question of the insularity at Van Diemen's Land, and he would report this to the Admiralty on his return. But in the meantime, he had to conceal it in his documentary records. So in his journal, rather than write an outright lie, he told a riddle. He wrote that anyone who wants to know whether Van Diemen's Land is joined to New Holland should compare his journal with Tasman's and then make their own judgment. This was a clever waffle from the plain-speaking Yorkshireman, and it worked. Nobody ever guessed. But his manipulation of his chart was even more ingenious. He invented a fictitious promontory of land extending 12 miles into the sea and named it Point Hicks. He positioned it on parallel latitude 38, exactly, which also served as the bottom edge of his map. He then drew a false coastline from the fictitious Point Hicks up to Ram Head and onto Cape Howe, thereby drawing a curtain across any hint of a strait. The result is a curiously unbalanced chart of Australia's east coast. At the top, it is rich in geographical context to the north and west of Cape York. But at the bottom, all the geographic context below the south coast of Victoria has been chopped off. But again, it worked. It kept Tasmania safe from the French for 30 years. Now, this brings us to Cook's second secret, Sydney Harbour. We are told that Cook barely noticed Port Jackson as he sailed past Sydney Heads after leaving Botany Bay. But this too was a cover-up. When Cook arrived at Botany Bay, he quickly realised that it was hopelessly inadequate as a naval port. It was too shallow and too exposed. Nonetheless, he anchored the ship off the south shore of the bay for the entire week, and he travelled about in a rowboat or on foot. At some point, he rowed across to the north shore of the bay and walked the well-worn Aboriginal track along the coast north to Bellevue Hill. This was the same track used 18 years later for social calls between the English officers of the First Fleet and the visiting Frenchmen on La Perouse's ships. It's still called Frenchman's Road in Randwick. From Bellevue Hill, he walked west along present-day Oxford Street and saw the vast waterway of Sydney Harbour. He immediately recognised its strategic value as a magnificent prize for the British Empire. It had to be kept secret for the time being, so he didn't write about it. Consequently, this overland walk can only be speculation, but there is very good evidence that it happened. The best documentary evidence is a memorandum written by Arthur Phillip before he left England with the fleet in 1787. Here Phillip indicates that he already knows about the many islands in the main harbour, which can't be seen from outside the heads. Then there is the Sherlock Holmes rule of evidence used by lawyers. Why didn't the dog bark? If Cook had seen nothing better than Botany Bay, then why didn't he investigate the other fine harbours as he passed them, as he sailed up the coast? Broken Bay, Newcastle, Port Stephens, Port Macquarie. As a naval officer, he had a duty to do so. But Cook never entered any of them. He didn't need to. He had the prize he wanted, and now he was going home. Now, his trip north was interrupted when the Endeavour hit the Barrier Reef. It was all hands to the pumps, including Joseph Banks, but he couldn't keep it up. He wrote, "Myself, unused to labour, was much fatigued and laid down to take a little rest." Even so, they miraculously got back to sea and eventually reached the top of Australia. Note that at no point when he was on the East Coast had Cook claimed possession. The Admiralty's instructions did not authorise him to do so, so he didn't. When he got to the top, he merely recorded that "the northernmost promontory of this country I have named York Cape." But he didn't get out of the ship. He didn't stop the ship. He didn't plant a flag, and he didn't otherwise celebrate. They all just wanted to go home to some roast beef and Yorkshire pudding. Now, they turned west and were sailing through Torres Strait. And to avoid Prince of Wales Island that was blocking their way, they turned south into the Gulf of Carpentaria. It was dangerously shallow, and a maze of islands obstructed any view of a clear passage ahead. So Cook looked about, as he usually did, looking for a hill. He noticed a high hill on a nearby island. He asked the marines to row him across to it and invited the gentlemen, as he called them, to join him. Joseph Banks and his Swedish friend Daniel Solander always welcomed a chance to leave the ship so that they could botanise. After rowing to the island, the marines stayed on the beach while Cook, Banks and Solander climbed the hill. From the top, they could see a clear passage through to what Cook called the Indian Seas. Down in the ship, the crew were watching anxiously. So Cook relayed the good news to them by raising his small ensign flag and firing his gun. The men recognised the signal immediately and cheered long and loudly. They were hugely relieved that they didn't have to back out and sail north around New Guinea, which would have cost them weeks. Instead, here was a clear passage through Torres Strait, so Cook named the place Passage Island and sailed on to Batavia, the big cosmopolitan Dutch port at Jakarta. It was here that Cook and Banks got the biggest shock of their lives. They were told that the French explorer, Louis Bougainville, had crossed the Pacific a year in front of them. He had told the Dutch that he had made lots of discoveries. He had been near the east coast of Australia, and indeed he may have landed there. This was a political emergency for Cook. It called for swift, decisive action. He had to forestall a French claim. Cook took a fresh piece of paper and drafted a new entry for the 22nd of August, which was the day when he stood on top of that hill in the Gulf of Carpentaria, when he had very few witnesses within earshot. He turned the signalling drill he'd done into a possession ceremony with great poetic license. He gave the name New Wales to the East Coast, and he changed the name of Passage Island into Possession Island. He then inserted the replacement page into a copy of his journal, which he bundled up and sent to Philip Stevens in London on the next departing Dutch ship, because he had to stay in Batavia for the ship repairs. It was pure genius, and it worked like a charm. For 250 years, the French and the English have assumed that Cook claimed Australia. In the end, this book is about the race for Australia. And it was a close-run thing. It also, incidentally, shows that you don't need to start a civil war to have a dramatic national story. Some historians have written that the French navigators were not interested in empire building, that they were only interested in scientific enlightenment for the benefit of mankind. But that's not true. Louis Bougainville did some empire building when he seized the Falkland Islands for France, using French-Canadian refugees as colonists. He had stolen George Anson's idea of using the Falklands as a supply gateway to more ambitious ventures in the Pacific. Someone was always going to seize this continent of New Holland, and for a while it looked like the French. Bougainville had preceded Cook. La Perouse arrived within days of the First Fleet. Napoleon sent Nicolas Baudin over here as soon as the news of the official discovery of Bass Strait reached Europe. Baudin's cartographer produced a beautiful map of Australia, festooned with lots of French place names, including a large swathe of country stretching from Melbourne to Adelaide, which he labelled the land of Napoleon. Someone tweeted, in your dreams. If France had got a foothold here, we may have had tastier croissants much earlier than we did. But we would also have suffered that great Anglo-French carve-up that's still causing grief in Africa and the Middle East. And so we are all luckier without that.
Many thanks to our speaker tonight. So as I said, we've got copies of Margaret Cameron's Ash book, Lying for the Admiralty, and that'll be on sale at the back there tonight with some of our staff. So now we come to questions discussion. We've got a bit of time. Could I start talking to you about Cook, James Cook? What was the problem? Why was he concerned that his reports of the Admiralty wouldn't go straight to the Admiralty? I mean, is it suggestions there were French spies in the Admiralty? Otherwise, why would it matter if he wrote down what he was doing, since he probably didn't envisage that French and others or the Dutch were somehow in on the Admiralty?
No, from what I can gather, his reports to the Admiralty were all verbal. And that was wise. It's not a good idea to put things on paper. The crew were his most immediate spies, and this was borne out when he was in Cape Town. And, of course, the baddies were not the French, but the East India Company. A few of the East India Company captains, and this is written in the book, got Richard Orton, who was his secretary, his clerk, on the Endeavour and was copying out the journal all the time and making several copies. They got him drunk and he sold them the coordinates of pretty well everything that he had been to. Now, Cook found out about this on St. Helena, somehow or other, and Banks, not Cook of course, but Banks records how furious he was, and then started a race for home because a lot of the East Indiamen were going with him. In fact, they won in the end because they couldn't get there. But it does show that it was, you just kept it all very secret and you didn't let anyone get hold of any paper.
What do the Admiralty records show? Did Stevens learn of this at some point? And what record was made in the Admiralty, presumably not for publication, about what Cook was discovered?
I have no idea. That is why I don't have... I have to look to Cook's own journal to look for the discrepancies to work out what happened. Because if there are Admiralty records, I'm sure they would have been found by now. Because I know people have certainly been looking about... Professor Alan Frost has been looking furiously for records of the reason for the decision to settle Australia in 1786. And I'm sure he would have found something. You just didn't put it on paper. And as Banks himself said much later, because we all live in London, there's only faint traces for posterity, because everything is done in conversation. And they just didn't make records, very few records, about early Australia. They didn't want to write it down.
Have we got the microphone and got the question? There's a question here.
Yes, thank you very much. Did Banks keep a diary about seeing Sydney Harbour? Does he make comments that indicate that...
No. There's no evidence that Banks... I don't think Banks made that trek.
So you said that you could find things mm-hmm. in Banks that weren't in Cook's. What would they be?
One example would be the possession, the non-possession. Now, Banks was standing shoulder to shoulder with Cook at the top of that hill. When Cook writes, and what you see on the paper is his substitute page, so you see in here, I realise that we could do no more and I have called this thing for King George III and so on. Banks's journal says, and we walked up to the top of the hill, it was the most barren hill I ever saw, and then we walked down again. So that's what I mean, the absence of position.
There's a question here. Yeah.
Thank you, fascinating. From subterfuge to survival, did Cook have prior knowledge of Cooktown and the sandy banks when he insisted to his crew that they should carry on and not go for the nearest land?
That has often been said. I don't know. It's not something that I studied. All that background about whether the Portuguese and all that business about the other maps, I think it's interesting. I keep an open mind. As yet, I don't think there's sufficient evidence to say he did, but I'm not closed on that.
There's a question here. Yes? You're right. Okay, so... hang on.
You mentioned the scientific enlightenment. As far as I know, Sydney is the only global city that owes its existence to the Enlightenment. How come we make so little fuss about this?
In what way does it owe its existence to the Enlightenment?
Well, Well, for example, if you compare the origins of Sydney with the origins of cities in North America, there's nothing about the Enlightenment and the origins of cities in North America that there is about Sydney. You look at the Botanic Gardens, sort of symbol of the Enlightenment, you know, the observatory and so on. We're full of them, but we don't care about them.
I do.
The suggestion here is that we focus on it, but other cities don't. That's the position, isn't it?
Well,
I don't know. You may or may
I think
not.
Other cities have botanic gardens.
Now, the question is not botanic gardens. The question is the impact of the Enlightenment, isn't it? Okay. This question.
I wonder if you could.
Wonder if you mind expanding a little on this concept of possession. I mean, does the fact that you stand on the top of a hill and say, I claim this land for King George, actually confer possession in the eyes of the French? Or, I mean, it seems such a simple thing to say, but in reality, you can't defend it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And by the late 18th century, it was pretty well meaningless. And Cook probably knew that. He, in fact, took possession of very few things, far fewer than through the Pacific, far fewer than people think, because it was a ridiculous notion. And even in the late 18th century, and this is why Bougainville took his French refugees to the Falklands, he knew that occupation was the only answer. Occupation was what counted. Now, what a proper claim for possession when you'd consulted with the indigenous people and all the rest of it, if you did it properly, which of course Cook didn't even attempt to do on this occasion, the most you could hope for in law was, not that there was an international law, but you got some sort of what they call an inchoate right to occupy it within a reasonable time, whatever that might mean. So you had to go and bag it, you had to go and put your suitcases down. Otherwise, somebody else could come and take it. And I think but there was another feature to this, and that is, and it actually goes back to possession by discovery rather than by a claim. And that is, the European countries in this Eurocentric world had a respect for the coastlines that you had discovered. And because they didn't want a battle in Europe, they wouldn't upset you on your new coasts. And that worked well enough until you found gold or something. But on the whole, if Cook said he'd taken possession of the East Coast, the French said, "Oh, okay. Well, we won't rough that up. We'll go and see what Victoria or Tasmania or something has to offer."
So there's a question here. Yeah.
How long did Captain Cook spend in Botany Bay when he first came? Because I noticed he lost one of his crewmen, Forby Sutherland, the first British to die on that soil. But if you, with your lawyer's hat, there's a bit of French territory out of La Perouse, which I'm not quite sure when it was given to them, but there was case law about 50 years ago where someone was drunk driving and he jumped in there and the coppers couldn't get him because he was regarded as French territory. So they waited around till he had to come out. That's why
he lost us.
Where precisely is that?
Yes, it's on the North Shore there somewhere. Yes, yes. Forby Southern, he died on the Southern Shore, but the French minister, wasn't it, died on the North Shore.
But we're not suggesting it was part of French territory.
Well, I don't know quite what the story is. No. It had nothing to do with Cook or La Perouse. But about 80 years ago or something, the French ambassador did do, because there is a French grave there from La Perouse's time, because his minister died, I think somebody gave it to France. Just the grave here.
Or just the grave?
Yeah.
Did they take it with them? Or? It's a question up here. Just yes. Come back here, will
you? In relation to the, when Captain Cook went through the Great Barrier Reef, he marked the coordinates, and some years later Bligh found the same passageway and found that those coordinates weren't exactly where Bligh saw them. Was Bligh in on the secret, or was he not aware of what was going on?
I don't think Bligh would have been in on the secret. I think it would have been very closed. As far as the coordinates not being correct, everybody had a longitude and a latitudinal error. Cook was pretty good. He did have both. He was pretty good. But as it happens, and I don't know why this was, the further north he got in Australia, the more out he was. And he got grossly out by the time he was at Cape York. Other people have commented on that and written bits about it. I'm not commenting on it, but it is true that he did have an error, and so that's probably what happened with Bligh.
There's a question there.
This is really fascinating, but I might have my facts wrong, but I seem to recollect that the first fleet actually entered Botany Bay first, in which case, if Cook had discovered, or if you think he discovered Sydney Harbour, kept it quiet, but he'd have let the Admiralty know. Why didn't Captain Phillip go straight into Sydney Harbour?
He almost did, in that he was there 3 days later. There's a very good reason for that. First of all, Botany Bay was a decoy, and a wonderful decoy. If you were driving past Botany Bay, you'd say, gosh, that's a pretty terrible bay, so I won't bother with that. So the advertisement for the whole of Australia was really, by this stage, Botany Bay. I'm bound for Botany Bay. No convict was ever unloaded at Botany Bay. It was a wonderful decoy. But a more immediate reason is that it would have been very dangerous to do that because the entrance to Sydney Harbour hadn't been sounded. And you weren't going to take 11 ships full of people across it without... Now, in the end, there was a sandbar there, but it was about 20 feet deep. And it was blown up early in the 20th century, I think. But yes, you wouldn't go in without checking to see that you could get in.
So there's a question down there. Just before we get there, does Cook need all this additional theory supported by some fact, or is achievement enough to go with them without adding what some might call fake news or supposition?
Yes, he does need it because he is sorely criticised for missing Bass Strait, for missing Sydney Harbour, and as we all know from the Pink Paint episode, for taking possession of Australia.
There's a question down there.
There's a statue of Captain Cook in Alaska. Did he tell the same fibs about the Northwest Passage, because the French, of course, were in North America at the time. Or is that why he is renowned enough to have a statue in Alaska?
Well, he spent a bit of time in Alaska. He poked around there for quite a long time. As to whether he told fibs, that's... So he certainly didn't about the Northwest Passage, but coming back to what is it? It's the Yang Fuka Strait. What's it called? The one down below, anyway. There was a thought that there was a Northwest Passage through there, and he does do some funny things there. He says, there's no strait there. Well, it was a clear day and there was a strait. Now, I haven't gone into that for several reasons. First of all, I think I'll leave that to the North Americans, and a few have spoken about that, and I think this book could egg them on a bit, because a few North American writers have made queries about what Cook did around Nootka Sound, Victoria Island, and so on. So they might be spurred on by this book. I'm not going to go there. My other problem with the third voyage is that Cook was not himself. And so it's very difficult to, at this distance, to work out what he might have been saying and what he wasn't. There are people who say he was perfectly healthy on the third voyage, but it's always been sort of said that he wasn't.
So just while we get into the question, what was on the third voyage, what do you think he was suffering from? What was he suffering from? What was the reason why he may not have been well?
He was, there are many theories about this, that he was exhausted. He was exhausted, he was behaving badly, he might have had some dietary problem, but... Yes, it's always it's well known that in fact some people say he started going crook halfway through the second voyage. I'm not sure about that, but it has often been a lot of his behaviour, particularly in Hawaii, is put down to bad health.
We're getting close to the end now. There's a question there.
You mentioned that he appeared to falsify a record in New Zealand. you're saying he circumnavigated the island, proved it was an island, but drew a peninsula?
New Zealand has three main islands, North, South and Stewart. Now, he went through Cook Strait, and that was one of the most important events of his life, because by doing that, he proved that New Zealand was an archipelago and that Alexander Dalrymple was wrong. And that was all he cared about. So he certainly shows Cook Strait. He then comes down the east coast of the South Island. They come to Vavoa Strait. They all see that it's a short strait, and the weather was good. Both Banks and Cook say the weather was good. They could all see it. But they didn't go through it, and the reason he didn't go through it was not so much to hide it from the crew, they'd seen it anyway, but he had to go down around the bottom of Stewart Island to prove that it wasn't joined to Antarctica. He just had to go until all the land was covered. So he goes down, he comes up, and there's that little island at the eastern entrance to Vavoa Strait, and all the crew say, oh, there's that little island we saw 3 days ago. Notwithstanding that, Cook says, he rubs out all, and I've got a photograph of his original page, he rubs out 10 lines of script, writes over it, and says, oh, that wasn't an island after all, that was a peninsula. And off he goes. And for the crew, because the crew's logs were never published, not within 100 years, no one minded.
Question here. John?
I was wondering, today the Sydney Morning Herald had an article by Jonathan Thurston, and he was set aback by reading about Cook and Curnell. And so if Cook made this journey, would he not have encountered some Aboriginals? And have you read much in the journals about the encounters with Maori and Aboriginal Australians?
Oh, yes. He mentions both of that. My book is not about that. My book's about Anglo-French rivalry, so I don't go into it. But there are some wonderful books about those first encounters. And, in fact, the one I like best, it's nice and short, but it's very perceptive, and that's by Maria Nugent, and it's called Captain Cook Was Here. And it makes an attempt to get to know what was going on in the minds, the fear and the desires and everything of what was going on with each group. And I think it's a very perceptive book, a very even-handed book.
Now just a final question. As you know, the celebrations are what next year? Are they 750, 250, or what is it next year?
Yes,
or?
Well, he's in New Zealand this year. Sorry. He's in New Zealand this year, 60, in 19. And so, yes, he comes across to Australia next year.
So he lands on what essentially these days would be called the Shire. But you're suggesting that he also may have taken a trip up to Wentworth, Malcolm Turnbull's over there. So there's conflict. I can see another conflict between Scott Morrison and Malcolm Turnbull here. So what do you think is going to be the response to your book and others come next year? Prime Minister's in the lodge. Member for Cook's in the lodge. Is he going to go for your theory that he did a trek into Wentworth, or is he going to stay with what the Australian calls the Messiah from the Shire?
Well, I think Scott Morrison will be very happy with this. I don't know how we're going to retroactively take possession of Australia, but I think we've clearly got to do something because we don't own it yet. So, but you can give that to Scott Morrison to deal with.
Well, thank you for an enlightening talk. I mean, I'm going straight home to make a claim, actually. It's pretty shocking news. Thanks for a very lively presentation, reminding us of Captain Cook and putting up some other theses as well, which, as certain as John Howard says in his introduction to this book, are certainly well worth considering. So you put a lot of work into it. There's a lot of facts, some theories, a lot of analysis, and most of all, it's timely and lively. So we thank you for coming here tonight. We've got some copies of Living for the Admiralty by Margaret Cameron Ash out there, and for tonight I'll just say thank you and good luck.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.